and welcome to Visa Talk, interesting discussions with interesting people from all around the world. I'm your host for today, Maria Roa, and I am delighted to be joined by Dave Ruan. Dave is the marketing director at XTM International, co-founder of the Localization Process Innovation Challenge. At the beginning of the year, he joined the board of directors of Gala because he didn't have anything else to do. I mean, like, no more work. I mean, Dave, you're always doing too many things. Dave also has a passion for technology, innovation, and language. He is proud to take an open approach to team building, solutions building, and knowledge sharing. Dave is a regular global content business speaker. And as a business consultant, he helps companies bring products and content to global markets. As if all this was not enough, he's passionate about line fishing and is based in beautiful Cali, Spain, in case someone doesn't know. Dave, welcome to the show. Bienvenido. We have a lot of things to talk about.
Thank you very much, Maria. Muchas gracias. Very nice to be here.
Well, let's start with the first question. I know you started out as a software engineer in the software sector. Can you tell our audience how did you go from there to problem solving and develop solutions in the localization industry?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like many people, let's say in the generation I started work with, I started in the localization industry, what is now 27 years ago. And I started in software localization engineering in Dublin, where I'm from, in Ireland. And it really was that kind of environment where Dublin at the time, the software sector was really this kind of attractive place where graduates found, let's call it an easy first job, not always an easy first job, but certainly there was a lot of jobs around at the time. There was a lot of different entry points that you could take. So I decided to take one coming from an electronic engineering background. I had reasonably good computer skills as well. So I took one in the localization sector, not knowing much about language, but certainly knowing about problem solving. So that's really where problem solving came from. It's this kind of engineering mindset, if you like, and then getting into software, which just developed it from there. Once I got into that world and understood how to do problem solving and how to get to root cause analysis, even more from a business and technical sense, it just became something that, you know, I stuck with. And I pursued a career in localization engineering, becoming senior engineer, engineering manager. I got into solutions development from there, which is a little bit more developing a solution for a new business. So it got me into proposal development and writing. And we're still just going into the late 90s. So the solutions area really opened up a whole idea of, oh, we're actually in the business and we have to make money. And so I understood, you know, how you go about packaging business proposals, what customers are looking for, you know, what was the kind of a discovery phase, needs analysis, pain points, all that kind of good stuff. So I was very lucky that I was able to kind of pivot the roles a little bit over about 7 years there to get into that. And I still feel I'm a kind of a solutions person at heart. And that's really stuck with me throughout my career, that ability to kind of look at stuff from different perspectives, bit of left field thinking sometimes, and then, you know, determine, well, is that the right problem we're solving? Have we defined it well enough? And then what kind of solution options could we look at? So not closing yourself down too much. And that really helped me. I moved to Spain, as you said, would you believe 20 years ago? So in 2003, this year it'll be 20 years. And as a result of that, I kind of needed to find work at the time, which was virtual, right? It's not like it is now, where virtualism is a great option for many people, which is fantastic. But at the time, I needed to look at job types that were more virtual. So that was consultancy, some operational management type roles, and then sales and strategic account management. So I got into that. So going from the tech side of things into consulting, and then as many of my engineering colleagues said, then I moved to the dark side into sales. And now I've kind of come around again into technology and back with marketing. But yeah, it's been absolutely fun. I would recommend to anyone is take a trip. You know, don't go straight up, or, you know, stay, try and zigzag if you can. Worked for me.
Well, you're in sales, but you're still in that helping with solutions side. So I think you're a little bit still linking with your beginnings, right? Because you're still helping people to find solutions. So it's a bit what you were doing at the beginning in a different way.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, sales and any sales related role, which all roles are at some point, they're about providing the right solution to the right customer, right? And so having an understanding of that, an understanding of their needs, you know, and really defining those out in any scenario, you've got to go there. In my mind, I haven't seen a good long term position by not going through a good solutions process, which is, you know, needs determining at the first step.
Well, in your introduction, I also mentioned that you were the co-founder of the Process Innovation Challenge. Can you tell us more about it? Where is it? I have no idea. Please let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the PIC, or the Process Innovation Challenge. It's a pitch-like competition, a little bit like Dragon's Den or Shark Tank. So depending where you watch your TV, what side of the Atlantic, it enables innovators this platform and an opportunity to pitch their ideas in front of an audience in the localization industry. And the whole concept came from back in the engineering days when I had a team of about 20 engineers. We had a weekly meeting. And one time someone, as we went around the table asking for status and issues, right, normal weekly meeting stuff, someone said, hey, I've been trying to solve this software build problem for the past 3 days. Anyone got tips? You know, it's driving me mad. And then someone else in the room said, yeah, I have a script for that and I'll send it on to you. And then the meeting continued and went around the table. I stopped the meeting. I said, whoa, what just happened here? And everyone was, what are you talking about? Why are you stopping the meeting? I said, somebody just spent 3 days of effort trying to debug something, solve something, when someone else had a script that would have solved it in 10 minutes. So we've missed an opportunity to share innovation. Now that it's solved, well, that's great, but it could have been solved earlier. How do we proactively solve these things? So after that and those meetings, we had a slot for innovations. And it became a big thing. And from there, we developed out an innovation group and the whole thing became very valuable to the organization. Now, years later, I was thinking, if that is happening with a group of engineers who actually work in the same office room within cubicles, surely in our industry, people aren't sharing innovations. Of course they're not. So it got me to think about a bigger scale idea. So I spoke to Ulrich Canis at Lockworld and I pitched it to him that, you know, we should really do something about this. He agreed. And we set up the first PIC, which was 6 years ago now in Barcelona, if I remember correctly. We basically have done 14 of them over those 6 years. We've had over 80 finalists, 250 submissions, and we've had 14 people who've won their awards, you know, Process Innovators of the Year. Now, we really have a premium about, it's not really about winning. Of course, that's a nice thing for a person who does, but anyone who gets to the final, and in fact, anyone who gets to the preliminary rounds now has got a really good story to tell. And really our idea with this is very much a labor of love, is to enable innovators to get their best selves on stage and get their idea out there. And what we found is this: every time somebody pitches, and I spot check this with the audience every time by asking people individually. And what I find is that out of six finalists, typically everyone in the audience, this is on average, will find two innovations that they feel they could apply in their jobs. And then maybe one other where maybe in the future it could apply, right? So that's the kind of baseline you're talking about. So we had last week we had the last version of it in Lockworld 49 in Malmo, and we had 360 people in the room. So imagine all of them finding two innovations that they could apply. So for the innovators on stage, it's great. You know, they hopefully they'll get conversations from people at the end of the event. They'll also get reach out from folks that they'll get more eyes on what they are trying to do. So it's helping them with their profile. The process to get them there, there's a lot going on behind the scenes. Even though it's a 1 hour session, there's a massive mentor prep because we run it really slick. We have fun, we have good intros, we have intermissions. It's a nice package, it's a show. And so beforehand, we do give coaching to the innovators so that they feel comfortable, because many of them with good ideas come from an introverted personality. So how do we give them a stage where they're comfortable, the coaching maybe they need? Many times what's happened is people have come with slides to us and said, look, here's my pitch, 30 slides. And I've said, no, hold on. You have 3 minutes in the preliminary, 3.5 minutes in the final. We give them 1/2 minute for free to pitch. So really, you're going to have to be going with the 3 to 5 slide range. You could have an embedded demo, that's fine, but the whole thing has to be very focused on the key essential, just the essential parts. And for many people, that transformation is difficult because they've always had, oh, I have to put that in, I have to, and I've done it myself. You know, you put a slideware together and you have so much stuff you want to fit in. Well, in the pick, we're basically saying you have to strip that off. Tell us what the problem is. Tell us something about your solution. What are the benefits, right? That kind of structure is what lends itself well. And then people who do that well and tell a good story and get some of themselves across, you know, the who rather than the what, they do very well. And we saw this time around. The audience voted, and the dragons, we have 3 dragons who are typically seasoned folks from the industry, although they can come from different parts of the industry. And they asked questions and they vote as well. So it was a lot of fun.
That sounds absolutely amazing. But I have a question. Is there a new edition of PIC every single Lockworld then?
That's right. So
the Lockworld, next one would be Lockworld 50 in Silicon
Lockworld League. 50 is going to have PIC number 15. So all the fives.
So if anyone from the audience that just heard you and didn't know about it would like to participate, what do they have to do then?
Call for papers will be open on the 1st of July.
Okay.
Right now, they can keep an eye on the Process Innovation Challenge. They can follow on LinkedIn or Twitter. So it's Process Innovation Challenge, and we can provide links. And once it's open, submit a paper. And the submission process is pretty easy. We're not asking for massive essays. We just want to understand what problem you're trying to solve. What is the innovation? Why do you think it's innovative? You know, and what's the applicability? So we have about 4 or 5 questions. And again, you don't have to give us essays. Just pertinent information with use cases would be great. Sometimes, Maria, these are concepts, right? And we have plenty of conceptual ideas which are not yet products, and they've got to the final. So it can be any kind of innovation. It doesn't have to be fully polished and final. It can be in the process of, and then you can show what you're able to show on stage. And so sometimes when people have shown concepts, they've just shown the idea, the expected gains that they're looking to get, and that's worked really well. So it doesn't have to be a final piece, and we just say get involved, because there's so many, as I call it, head fakes in games for people, but the people innovators are going to meet, the dragons they'll meet, the getting used to the stage experience, preparing for that, getting coaching. Like, there's a lot of positives for anyone who gets involved.
Okay. So now let me talk a little bit more about your consultant side at XTM. What do you think companies should be looking for when searching for a language technology tool? Are there top 3 things they should take into account?
How long have we got here? I'll try and keep us to that. But look, the whole landscape has shifted in the last 5 to 10 years in terms of technology. And when I started in the industry, you were getting towards a situation where large language service providers were creating this kind of BPO model, right? Business process outsourcing to end customers, enterprise buyers. And now we've seen a shift where enterprises have wanted to have more ownership in terms of what's happening in localization processes, in terms of assets, in terms of IP and control over IP. And then other security elements have come into play, right? Security audits have suddenly become this massive thing now in tenders. So this has paved the way for systems such as a translation management system like we provide, which help companies manage those programs. So now you have a whole plethora of systems, TMS or TBMS, and other language technology platforms that enable management of that program and process area. And what I think you asked for three things. You know, first one I would say is have a strategic vision. And this is an easy one for me to say and for people to say, well, oh, it's an obvious one. But where your localization program and strategy could not go in 3 months or 6 months, but 3 and 5 years, right? So what is the vision? And sometimes for teams that are just so busy, this is not the ideal exercise they want to take on. But I'll tell you something, like, you know, some of the events, such as events that you guys run, Localization World Conference, Gala Conferences, all of these events, you will find people who will be very willing to help you understand what that strategy could look with or look like. And I think that's key to doing that vision bit when you're looking for language technology. And in particular, what you'll find is if you do that process, there'll be things that you want after year one, year two, year three, and so on. And it'll start to look a bit different. And that will determine things like, okay, hold on. We look like we're going to be growing quite a lot from year two to three in terms of scale. We're really going to scale the global content that we're producing in that period of time. Well, then question is, well, will your platform enable you to scale at that time? Another company might say, hey, we're not going to scale much over the next 5 years. We just need some technology that enables us to kind of start here and stay around that line. Okay, that's a good vision and an absolutely legitimate vision. So then your technology choices can be for particular technologies that enable you not to have to need other plugins or expansion of volume, scale, growth of new usability features. I'll give you an example. You know, someone might start with human translation workflows. They want to manage their translation memories and have terminology managed. Translation management system can be a good option there. In 2 years' time, they may feel that they will use machine translation or generative AI or whatever engine is available at the time, but they're not there at the moment. So they would need a system that enables them to plug into those systems in 2 years' time. And so that vision, in my mind, it's just absolutely essential to get that right, because when you are looking for any kind of language technology, longer term approach is key. Most of the platforms now can take on any new fad technologies and plug them in, right? This is something we can talk more about, but that's happening. It's always been happening. When MT started, it used to be rule-based statistical MT. It was really kind of an academic area for a long time. I remember seeing it and then asking people, what are the use cases, and being told many years ago, we don't have any yet. Okay, we'll keep working on the training. And, you know, over time, some use cases came in, but they were the like small minority. And then that shifted quickly when neural machine translation came in. So I would just say that technologies will adopt and change. What having a system that can allow you to plug in the new stuff is really important.
Oh my God. Yeah, you were right. It wasn't an easy question.
I think I've covered one of the three, but we'll get to others later.
No. Yeah, we will. But actually, I wanted to talk a bit about something that you started talking, because you started talking about MT, but I also want to talk about artificial intelligence, which is not the same, but let's say it's kind of like a higher technology than MT, because a couple of weeks ago, I talked to Sharon O'Brien, the Associate Dean for Research, Faculty of Humanities and Social Science at Dublin City University, on a recent episode of BISA Talks. I think it was episode 118. And we discussed the new reality we live in, which is the content created by artificial intelligence. And I thought this was going to be like one of the top three things that maybe we need to take into account now. So I want to ask you about this. I asked her at that moment, what impact do you feel artificial intelligence will have or is already having in the localization industry now? Is it something that we need to take into account now?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, these are the kind of valid things that you know, I was at a conference last week, as I mentioned, and people are just wondering all the time, you know. And for me, it goes back to some fundamentals in technology, such as rate of change, right? Rate of change is something to keep an eye on, because sometimes technologies come out, but their deployment takes longer, right? Anyone who's used Windows operating systems for a long time will know that when a service pack would come out after the main release, you should probably just wait before installing that service pack, right? And of course, Microsoft and other software vendors got much better on ensuring that there was very stable service packs. But you know, way back when, Windows 2000 NT systems like that, you would give it time. So you weren't going to deploy that cool new delightful technology, as Kano calls it, immediately. And what we're finding is that conversion from delightful technology, you know, I remember a long time ago when I saw someone's car and it had electric windows when I was young. And I said, oh my God, that is so cool. We don't have electric windows. And they had a nice BMW and the windows went up and down. We played with it all the time. It was a delightful technology at the time. Over time, what happened was, this became a basic needs technology that other car manufacturers use, and not just the top of the range BMWs. Mm-hmm. So this is how technology, as Kano puts it in his model, it goes from a delightful need to a basic need over time. So what's delightful today becomes a basic need technology later. So let me just leave you with that starting mm-hmm. point. In our space, you know, machine translation, I mentioned earlier, it took quite what seems like a long time before it became usable. So the rate of change of the technology getting to the point where it could be used was not super fast. I remember when CAT tools, in particular Trados, when it came out first, it was one of the first proper CAT tools in the space, among others, but certainly the most popular at the time, and I'm talking about 20 years ago. Some people didn't want to use a CAT tool, right? I remember visiting a customer one time in the energy sector and talking to them about, well, how can we deal with getting your service manuals into the translation process? And they said, well, you know, we don't want any digital stuff going on. And I said, sorry, what? Yeah, so our service manuals are in this storage room, in this facility, and they're stacked high, and there's about 5,000 pages. And I was saying, okay, and you want those to be, what, translated? Yeah, translate them. And we have lots of notes on them. So there was this kind of feeling that, no, well, this is what I need done, and I don't want to know about digitization. And right, you know, fast forward to now, in the last 10 years, digitalization has become a massive thing, in particular in those industries, legacy industry, they're really going through with Industry 4.0, a whole digitalization ecosystem change, if you like, and revolution. In our industry, it took time with the AI to do that. When neural machine translation came out, this rate of change factor started to increase because there was people were looking at the base technology and then figuring out, oh, I can create a product, a niche product from that, and it can do A, B, and C. So productization of the platform started about 7 years ago, I'd say, approximately, probably a bit before that. And then we've now seen, you know, NMT engines. We've had aggregators in the field as well, right? Intento, for example. So it's matured in terms of the productization side. So why am I saying all this? Well, I just want to set the ground for it took years for the rate of change and the rate of adoption of new tech in our industry to happen. We're now there, and there's while there's plenty of hype about the generative stuff, there's also a lot of interest that people have in how can I deploy, how can I get the next gain from this new technology? How can I, you know, apply it in particular use case? And that's going to happen in the next year. Already last week, we're starting to see people think on this.
So maybe next year, artificial intelligence will be a necessity. Well, as you say, like as the will of the automatic windows, right?
Well, you know, there've been kind of the, you know, drums of doom, if you like, banging a little bit over the past few years. There was uncertainty, certainly in the linguist world as to, well, what is this going to mean for us? And what's the pressure going to be on both pricing, but also what we get and ownership over being able to do a good job and all of these very important matters. And I think there's still unknown churn going through and to be cycled through. What was telling last week, and I think every conference from now, people are going to pick things up, is we seem to be passing that inflection point where, you know, companies recognize they have to work with generative AI, and you've just got to get in there. And if you leave it to the, you know, laggards or the late majority group and the kind of bell curve of adoption, then that's not a good place for you or your company. So More and more people are moving into the innovators group, that small little sliver in the bell curve, or the early majority, and seeing it as we got to be in and be up with the Joneses before the Joneses, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I do. Oh my God, let's move into the next question. I feel like we're getting so much information. I don't know if I'll have time to ask you everything I need to, but do you have shared publicly that Andrés Fidrón, CTO at XTM, somewhat shocked you with what he discussed on a stage at XTM Live, and you claim it was the best set of insights you have seen on the whole area of open AI and AI in the localization space. Can you share some of those insights here with the worldwide audience?
Yeah, so transparency, right? I work with Andy. I've known Andy a long time, over 20 years. Okay. I'm absolute fan. I think he's a pure genius. And there are a few in our industry, I would definitely vote for him as one of them. And he's just such a lovely guy, unassuming. I've learned a lot from him. So all that said, you know, I'm a fan of people who help you learn by teaching simply, right? Mm-hmm. And don't have anything in the game. So there's no kind of self-promotion that they're trying to achieve by teaching. And Andy does that very well. And that's really where I was coming from. He did a piece on in about 40 minutes on large language models and just explained them for people so that they understood, you know, when they started to be built, what the, you know, inflection point paper, there was a Google paper a number of years ago, I think in 2017, which really set this in motion. And he then showed a map of all of the different LLMs. And I was surprised to see that, you know, the OpenAI wasn't the biggest one on the map, right? So there's a lot of these. Like if you look at car manufacturers, there's probably ones we don't know of that actually sell lots of cars, right? Well, same idea here. And he explained in those terms that really But what this is another set of engines that can be plugged in to workflow process, but also technology like a transition management system. And we liken it, I always use the kind of mechanic and garage analogy. So, you know, technology, if it's done right and it's well set up, particularly language technology, it can be like a garage with mechanics, right? And that they have car chassis that they provide, and they can plug in and out the various engines that you need to work with. You can change the wheels, the tires, you know, you can put things in and out, but you have a solid garage platform that you can do these things in. And I think that is not really going to change, that, you know, enterprises in particular, but anyone who is using services or requires translations will want to have a platform that they can then plug in the latest and best new technology. Because let's face it, OpenAI is going to be in the rearview mirror to a degree when the next ones come along, right? So this is a phase that we go through. It's just accelerating faster. So it seems like it's going super fast. As I mentioned earlier, the rate change has really accelerated. But again, it's just technology that gets plugged in.
So what do you think, and I know this is going to be a hard question, but I want to know from you, what do you think are the next localization trends that we need to look out for?
I think what I would always say is that if you kind of move up to the KBO level, so what are the key business objectives that enterprise companies have? You know, you're still going to come around to some of the old favorites. It's ROI on investment, right? So what's our value? Our value to time, our value to profit. How is our time to market being, you know, as instant as possible? And brand voice, you know, how are we impacting brand voice across all of our target markets, communities. So, you know, that can get intrinsic when you go into multilingual markets as to, you know, does the brand voice of a company stay the same? Does it vary depending on the content and demographics and the level of personalization that they put into it? So I think if you start there, then you can start to figure out, okay, what trends are going to help meet much of that. And I think one of the big trends is that, which has been going on for quite a while, is that content has to resonate, all right? And so that content cannot just be a transformation from source into target. A number of years ago at the Process Innovation Challenge, we had a young lady go up on stage, and at the time, I did not know anything about that person. And I was talking to her before she went on, and we had a chat. I was just making sure she was good to go and feeling comfortable on stage and in front of the podium. And after our chat, she was speaking quite quietly, and I was just reflecting that. She went on stage, and this tiger appeared on stage. I was literally, standing back. And she had this idea she was absolutely passionate about, and she had built a story around why the psychology of translating source text is wrong, and how you can actually get around it and get translators to create the right kind of translations by not using source text. And then she showed the business benefits that she had achieved for her company, who's in the financial app space, by doing this. And this is her story that she did in 3.5 minutes. That was Julia Tarditi, who's now with Qualtrics, and who's a bit of a localization superstar. And she had done something which was unintuitive, but made sense to her, and got it out there. And now that's more of a standard process that people have taken on. So why am I telling you this story? Well, I think what we're going to see in terms of trends is people looking for left field ways to manage some of those KBOs that I mentioned. And so using in different ways and different use cases will apply some of the new tech in different ways, but using them to meet specific goals. So we're going to be a lot more goal aligned. I think another thing you're going to see is connectivity is just going to be a basic need. So, you know, as a TMS provider, XTM, we provide a huge array of connectivity. You probably see some behind me, actually. But that is just basic need. Systems have to connect together. And anyone who's buying technology or services is going to expect that. We're going to see that more and more now, that it's not, do you have a connector for A, B, and C? It's, we expect that you have. And that narrative is shifting as buyer habits change. You know, buyer habits are becoming more insistent on, well, we expect to have A, B, and C. I did a session in Berlin at an e-commerce event earlier this spring, in February, and we were talking about how certain buyers in certain markets, when COVID happened and they switched to digital, after COVID was all but over, they stayed on digital and didn't switch back, which is kind of interesting. So let me give you an example of that. France is a very interesting market for high fashion. So if you look at luxury brands and high fashion retail, when COVID hit in, people went digital. So they went to all their favorite brands online and they still bought their nice clothing or apparel, whatever it was, they could do it online. When COVID stopped, the vast majority in France went back to the in-store experience because they had in-store, right? Whereas if you look at countries such as Bulgaria or other countries in what was Eastern Europe, they did not have that luxury brand experience in store as legacy. It didn't exist. So when they went online and found that luxury brands were online as well, speaking to them in their language, they loved the experience. Many people, they got attached, and experience is a key word in this space. And after COVID, they stay there, right? So these retail e-commerce companies notice this. So this is what they call the latent market. So it wasn't a market that fashion retailers would have noticed before, but because of circumstances and buyer habit changes, they suddenly had a latent market, and anyone who was in early did incredibly well.
That's really weird for me. I think that's because they actually, it is the reason it is, as you said, because they haven't lived the actual real fashion luxury in-person action, because it has nothing to do.
Well, yeah, this is it. It's when you don't have something, you say, well, no, I just buy bread and butter and that's my breakfast. And suddenly someone opens a French bakery across the road, you're having croissants every day. You didn't think you were going to have croissants a year before. Right? At the Process Innovation Challenge, we actually had somebody, Frederick Pedersen from Easy Translate, and he was talking about, he made a really cool point about our industry. And he said, look, people think that we're like this 50, 60 billion. It's always been the number that's been floating around. And he argued that, no, that's in his mind rubbish. And he said that we're a 160 billion industry. And we're just not seeing all of the other opportunities, the other latent pieces that can actually come into play. And I think many service providers have started or are well on their way to seeing those markets and trying to tap into those. But that's massive, 160 billion. You know, that really tells us the opportunities that are available. And, you know, tells me that, you know, there's a very rosy future. Even if you automate a large amount of that, you're still going to require creative people to take on creative roles and manage that at linguistic project management on all levels.
Wow. It's really interesting. I'm still thinking, like, how can they get people? I mean, it's really interesting. We should really look into all those markets that, as you said, I never thought they could make it into the online market. Like, seriously, the luxury brands, I never thought they could make it into the online market. Because the service they offer to the people, only the service they offer to the people in person, it's something you cannot get when you go online.
Well, this is the whole dichotomy, isn't it? Where, you know, how do you mirror the experience in store versus online? And I think they're starting to get closer to understanding that each has a role. But here's the thing, if you don't have an in-store experience, you never knew that. So yeah. you don't care about the
I
fact.
I agree. That's what I'm thinking. That you
never had someone bringing you a cappuccino with a biscuit on the side when you're, you know, having a look at dresses, they don't, right?
You've never been like open the door. You never got a glass of champagne when you enter into the shop. You know, you never know. You just got like this really nice little package that came, you know, like with a beautiful box and a bow. And you thought that was your experience, and your experience was amazing already. So, yeah. So I understand their experience was amazing in the mail and the bow and everything and the box and everything they sent was extremely good, because I've seen it online and they even sent you like samples of like the cologne and whatever. So you think that experience is luxury, but compared to what you get in the store, for me, it's nothing.
Right. And that's, you've used the legacy environment and system, and then new buyers won't even know that. So, you know, the experience, which is a great word, I think. And I remember talking to someone in the video game sector a number of years ago and asked them, what's the most important thing about localization for you? And they said that our players remain in the game experience, and they don't feel that a bad translation can bring them out of that, so that they're always in the experience. And I think more and more sectors are understanding that the experience is what people are looking for. They want to have a positive brand experience online. This so
so amazing. You made me think about it. It's great. Thanks so much for that. That was great. One last question. Do you feel that companies no longer see localization as a cost center as they may have done in the past? Because we recently ran a series of localization leadership and how people can become the champions in their company for global content and localization activities. Do you think companies have fully embraced the understanding that localization teams and departments are critically important?
Yeah, I think it tends to be a kind of a, you know, swings and roundabouts, as we say in Dublin, right? You can get, by and large, I think that there's an overall understanding of the importance, right? When you see companies saying that, you know, 56% of our revenues come from outside of the US, which is our headquartered space, or others saying it's 70 or 80, you know, this kind of revenue statistics isn't lost on companies that are new into the space. If they're, you know, a startup that's really starting to branch out and look for revenue, immediately they'll pivot more and more quickly, as I mentioned, the rate of change stuff earlier, to going global rather than leaving it until they have other systems in place. So I really think from that perspective, it's seen as, you know, as I call it sometimes, existence. We have to get existence in the market quickly. We then want to make sure that the close to existence, and this wasn't always the case, you know, sometimes you'd have existence in a market, but the content wasn't translated well, and it didn't resonate, and it didn't have a sales impact. But now more and more existence has been married with customer experience in that market. So that's kind of a long way to go about seeing that the value of that, when it's brought in with customer experience and sales in country, then the value of localization is, you know, it's much higher than it was previously. There's still the whole, you know, is it a cost center rather than a profit generation center? And that debate will continue. And there's many people in our industry who've flown the flag very high for making that seen as, you know, part of the C-suite, you know, and by doing it themselves and showing how important is to a company that it should be part of the executive branch and way up there. And I think that's great, because once you have those examples, then other people can take those as inspiration, drive in that direction themselves. And many globalization, localization managers and directors are thinking that way because they've seen other people do it. So that's fantastic.
We still have like a bit of work to do.
Sure, always. It's a journey.
Okay, so before we go, is there anything you're working on or anything you would like to share with us?
I really think the, you know, impact, the potential with some of these generative AI technologies is going to, it's probably going to keep some people like me and others busy over the summer, looking into, hey, how can I use this in different ways? And so it's the kind of playground that I remember when mobile phones first came out in Ireland, and a few of us had them and were playing with SMSs and, you know, ringing each other up for fun and then hanging up, you know, all that kind of stuff. Well, that playground attitude, I think, we'll see with OpenAI, generative AI in general. And I'm looking forward to get stuck in. And then I have a few other programs that are really exciting I'm looking forward to, which I'll be able to tell about in a few months' time. That's almost maybe Apple-esque right there.
Okay, maybe we need to talk about it again in a few months' time. But I agree. I'm also playing with the AI a bit, like in my free time and checking what it can do, how it could help and stuff like that. It's always interesting, you know, to be in the loop and check how it could help in the future. So, well, thank you so much. That's the end of today's show with Dave Ruan. Please make sure to tune in again to see and or to listen to the next Business Talk show, where we will be discussing more interesting topics with interesting people from all around the world. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you, Maria. It's been a pleasure.